Welcome, everybody. This is Robert Nuttleman of the Nuttleman Law Firm, and today we are speaking with Suzanne Wertheim of Worthwhile Research and Consulting. Worthwhile Research and Consulting is a boutique firm applying social science to real-world problems. They provide customized diversity training and communication workshops, legal consulting, and continuing legal education and communication coaching. So, Suzanne, what does all that mean?
Well, that's a really good question. So, first of all, let me say that I am a linguistic anthropologist by training, right? So,
now I got to stop you, because what is a linguistic anthropologist? Because when I first met you and you told me you were a linguistic anthropologist, I could barely say it, let alone know what it is.
I know, and the thing is that my field has done such a terrible job of PR over the years that people genuinely don't know what it is, and it sounds, people say, oh, it sounds so esoteric, or how many languages do you speak? But it really means that, first of all, I've got a PhD in linguistics from Berkeley, and then I've taught in both linguistics and anthropology departments. I taught at Northwestern, I was at University of Maryland, I was at UCLA, and what I did was I helped people understand how language expresses social meaning. How does language work? How does language express social meaning? We do it all the time. Language isn't something that's just floating out there like an object. It's actually something that's part of communication and social relations. And so it sounds really fancy and distant, but basically anytime people speak or write something, you can use the principles of linguistic anthropology to analyze it and figure out more deeply what's going on.
So you're taking what people say, what they write, maybe even how they express themselves non-verbally, visual mm-hmm. cues, to help determine, you know, what are they actually communicating? Are they communicating other things? Is that close?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So what we think about is language is having more than one stream of meaning. So for almost all of human existence, people have had face-to-face conversations. It's only very recently that we've been able to, I mean, so there was letter writing, and then there have been telephone calls, and now we have a wide range of ways to talk. But thinking of starting with face-to-face conversations, we give all kinds of cues in a whole bunch of ways as to how we feel about ourselves, how we feel about the person we're speaking with, and how we feel about the things that we're saying, all right? And so with linguistic anthropology, in other fields, for example, law very often focuses on semantics, the meaning of the word. But with linguistic anthropology, you're looking at semantics as one stream of information, and that there are other streams of information that you can look at very systematically. So the way I like to talk about it is that we all feel social meaning of language. If you're talking to someone, you have been learning over the course of your lifetime to interpret the cues that people give you. You can feel, do they like me, do they not like me? Do they think they're on the same level as me, or are they trying to place themselves above me? We can all feel that, but it takes training to be able to isolate and analyze and articulate exactly what's going on that gives you those feelings and those interpretations.
Okay. Well, I notice different cultures, different backgrounds have different ways of communicating. You know, if I have a client or an opposing side or just somebody I meet on the train and they're from a different culture, a different nationality or a different upbringing, the words they use and how they use those words can sometimes have different meanings from how I understand those words. And does linguistic anthropology take into consideration kind of the cultural differences?
Yes, and in fact, linguistic anthropology can be very systematic about it as well. So that actually is a great lead-in to talk about. So if you started by saying, here's what your firm does. So one of the things that we do is diversity training, right? So how do you give diversity training? Well, one of the things is that you teach people, or I teach people, how to be very systematic in their understanding of what's happening. So it's not just, it's good that you're very astute. Obviously, as a successful lawyer, you have to be very attuned to words and how they're used. But there are actually other principles of communication that are at play, and what happens is there's this process that, in my field, we call socialization. So from the time you're in your mother's womb, throughout your entire life, you're socialized into understanding how things are supposed to go, what's normal, how it's supposed to be. And so one example that people start to recognize a lot if they travel around the country is how much silence there's supposed to be in a conversation. This is something that people almost never talk about explicitly, but if you're raised in different parts of the country or with a different ethnic or racial background, you're going to have a different understanding about the systematic rules of how a conversation is supposed to work. So, for example, I grew up in New York of Mediterranean descent, Middle Eastern descent, and so the norms for my culture are no silence in a conversation. If you have someone speaking and then there's a silence after they conclude their turn, it means something is terribly wrong. And there's this incredible coordination that goes on where people will jump onto the very end of somebody else's turn. They know when the end of the turn is coming and they jump in. But for someone who grew up, for example, of Swedish or Norwegian descent in Minnesota, the opposite is true. And so they grow up with an understanding that you need to have a silence, usually about 0.7 seconds between a turn, and then you know that the first person is ready to hand over the conversational baton, and then it's your turn to speak. So what happens when a person from one culture and another one meet? There's a lot of confusion and problems that can arise.
Well, and I see a lot of that. I do primarily employment law, and I represent both employees and employers. And oftentimes, conflict can arise in the workplace, and it results from either just miscommunication, one person not saying what they intend to or saying what they intend to and somebody interpreting it incorrectly. Are there ways that studying linguistics and understanding where people are coming from can resolve conflict or avoid conflict in the workplace?
Yeah, I think it can. So one thing I've learned is, so for example, I was just talking about something as basic as the principle of how do you know when it's your turn to speak? And what we find is that when people who are raised with different norms, which are implicit, nobody in Minnesota is saying to their child, okay, now what you want to do is wait 0.7 seconds, and then you know that it's your turn to speak. Literally no one is saying that. But the human mind is amazing, and so you just learn that that's the way to be. What we find is that when people from one conversational culture meet another one, and it doesn't have to be someone comes from another country, there's often a hint, right? Like they have a different last name, they might speak with an accent, so you're like, oh, okay, they have different rules. But when a New Yorker and a Californian meet, and they might have a pretty standard American accent, they might not know that there are different rules. And so what you find is that, for example, when a person from a silent culture meets with a person from an overlap culture, they end up with very different opinions of the other. They start to think things about the other's personality or what their relationship is. So if you come from a silent culture and you meet someone from an overlap culture, you might think, that person's so rude, they only care about themselves, they don't care what I have to say, they didn't give me a chance to speak, what an arrogant jerk, or worse words, right? And if you're the person coming from the overlap culture, you're like, what's wrong with that person? They didn't care. They didn't want to talk. They were too timid. They were afraid to say something. They must not know what's happening. There start to be all of these values that get attributed to the other person and something as basic as just turn-taking. But if you start to give people an awareness and say, hey, here's something you should be aware of. Why don't you categorize yourself and then you can let your coworkers know. I recently gave a diversity training workshop down in Silicon Valley. When I started to introduce this concept, everyone burst out laughing and started pointing at one guy in particular. You know, and it turned out that he, first of all, came from the Middle East and then also came from a family that was very talkative. And this was just a big problem in his workplace. But once you give people the terms and you start to make it less about an individual's personality and more about the way they were raised, you can make it so people feel not so angry or not so resentful and start to see it as something that's more a principle of communication that they can figure out and work around.
You mentioned diversity training, and I'm assuming diversity training is one of the things that Worthwhile Research and Consulting does. What other types of services does Worthwhile Research and Consulting provide?
Well, another thing that we've just started offering is language and bias continuing legal education that fits the elimination of bias credit, which I know can be hard to find for people. So,
and the elimination of bias in particular has been kind of somewhat of a hot topic. In the last couple of years, we've really been developing or teaching more and more about unconscious bias that,
mm-hmm.
that people have. Are there clues within our language that can indicate whether or not there's an unconscious bias going on?
Yes. In fact, what we find is that language, first of all, language is the medium of interaction, right? And so by analyzing language, it seems to be able to give us the best kinds of insight into unconscious bias or implicit bias that are going on. Let me give you an example that's hot in the news the week that we're talking about, right? So one thing that's happening is people are looking at performance evaluations in the workplace. So in employment law, there's a certain kind of performance assessment that might come into play where you could analyze coded language or people's responses and see if there's some kind of bias at play. But because the quantities of those evaluations are small, it's hard to make generalizations. But just this week, there's a lot of press about studies that have been done on student evaluations of professors. And because student evaluations happen in large numbers, you can do interesting studies and find things out. But so the method of evaluation is linguistic, right? There is a form that students fill out. And then if they give free-form comments, then that is also language that can be analyzed. What they found in these studies, one was done in France, one was done in the U.S., is that student evaluations do not have no correlation to teaching effectiveness, zero correlation. But they do show very clear gender bias, both in France and in the U.S. And who was demonstrating more bias changed depending on the location. So it looked like it was male students expressing more bias in France and female students expressing more bias in the U.S. But what they found was, regardless of who was doing it, women were on the receiving end of the bias. And they even did something, very clever, where now that there's online instruction in a way that there didn't used to be, if there's online instruction where there's no voice involved, where everything is text-based, then you can do something called a match the guys test, where the only thing you change is one component. So what they had was male instructors and female instructors sometimes teach under a male name and sometimes teach under a female name, but it's the same instructor. So if your name is Paul, you might go by Paula. If your name is Michelle, you might go by Michael. And what they found very, very consistently was that the male instructors were evaluated higher than the female instructors, even if they were the same person with the same name.
Interesting. You know, speaking of evaluations, there was a case here in the Silicon Valley that gained probably national attention, the Ellen Powell case.
Yeah.
And one of the issues in that case, one of the things that the plaintiff was contending, is that she was rated lower than her male counterparts, and that there were words and phrases that were used in those evaluations that indicated a gender bias. Ultimately, the jury did not find in Ellen's favor. And I'm wondering, would somebody in your field have benefited, or could you have helped Ellen Powell's case, or the defense case for that matter, you know, had they come to you and say, look, you know, here's these evaluations, what can we determine from these evaluations?
Absolutely. And so I'm not really sure who was on her case, and there was a talk at Stanford not long afterwards that I didn't get a chance to go to, and I was very curious to hear. This person, who is a feminist scholar, said that her claims were somewhat weak, which was interesting. But I know from personal research, I've been doing research with women in the tech industry in Silicon Valley. I just moved back to the Bay Area last March. And since about that time, I've been doing personal interviews, reading first-person narratives, etc., and looking at what seem to be very consistent examples of gender bias. And I've been sorting them into categories, right? And so mm-hmm. one thing that I'm finding, and it comes through, there are several ways it comes through. So the first way is gatekeeping when it comes to the idea of whether you're going to be hired or not. That's the first thing that happens, right? So that's the first discrimination barrier. The second one is what goes on in the workplace as you have interactions with colleagues. And then the third is what happens when you're evaluated by a manager. So for the first one with hiring, I'm trying to think of his name, but there's a guy who runs Sequoia Capital, which is a big VC firm. That might be the one that Owen Palacios was about. And so he was asked, I think about a month ago, somebody said to him, what's going on with gender diversity? At your firm, you don't have very many women. And he talked about an individual that he had hired from Stanford, and he said she's just as good as her male peers. And he said something like, we're interested in diversity, but we don't want to lower the bar. And so there was a lot of backlash because a lot of people said, why is there a link in your mind between hiring women and lowering standards? No one said, are you willing to lower your standards? So what people believe, you know, so you, as a linguistic anthropologist, you look at that connection between talking about hiring women, marking that it's almost remarkable that this woman you've just hired is just as good as her female as her male peers, and then saying, you know, we're happy to hire women, we don't want to lower the bar, why is lowering the bar even an option? This suggests that there's an implicit bias at play, where his base assumption is that females are not going to be as competent as males.
So the fact that they were asking, somebody was asking him about the lack of women in his firm, and he connected, without anybody associating, the oh, we're hiring more women, but we don't want to lower the bar, the making of the connection of those two points can be an indicator of unconscious bias?
Exactly. It's exactly that, because who made the connection? He did in a split second. He changed the topic from hiring women to hiring people who are not as good, right? And so it shows that there is this linkage. Another thing that happens is colleagues in the workplace, very often women in tech, because we're adjacent to the tech world and because there are so many very negative stories coming out of there, I just want to focus. I've been focused on that, right? So it seems a little more dramatic than in some other workplaces. In fact, I was talking to a plaintiff's employment attorney. I gave a talk at a plaintiff's firm over in San Francisco a couple of months ago, and she used to do a lot of work with Wall Street, and she said that now Wall Street's had enough training that people are being less obvious in their behavior, and it's tech companies that are engaging in very clearly discriminatory or biased behavior.
Okay.
So something that I'm finding a lot is that there are more subtle ways that if you're a linguistic anthropologist, you can see women know that they're feeling like they're being demeaned or marginalized. This is something that is a very common, this is the category that I'm using, but I've been interviewing person after person and saying, tell me about problems that you've had in the workplace. And their story leads to feeling that they were being treated like they're not really part of the group, outgrouped, or feeling treated like they are lower. So let me give you some examples. One is just not being recognized as having the job that you have. So people who were software engineers, a few of them, more than one, told me that they had desks adjacent to somebody in a closed office who was an executive, and they were repeatedly mistaken for being his assistant and not a software engineer. Right? So just that expression says, oh, I assume because you're a woman, you're not doing tech work. Right? So it was this assumption saying, oh, you're not part of my group. You're a part of another group, one that's not valued as highly. Another thing that we find happening a lot is that women are expected to do domestic, quote unquote, domestic tasks or secretarial tasks that men are not expected to do. So taking notes in a meeting, bringing coffee. I've even been reading stories of female executives that are expected to bring coffee even when there are lower ranked men involved in a meeting.
Well, I just read an article recently about a judge, I believe in San Mateo County, who was reproached by the Judiciary Committee because he repeatedly was engaging in conduct that indicated a gender bias, including directing at least one female attorney to go get him a cup of coffee, whereas he has never done that for any of the males. And, you know, he apologized and said he didn't intend any type of discriminatory bias. And quite frankly, I see that a lot where the thing with an unconscious bias is it is unconscious.
Okay.
I think it's difficult psychologically for anybody to view themselves as a racist or being prejudiced, whether it's against somebody's gender or against their nationality or the color of their skin. And so we're oftentimes that person's going to come into the workforce with these underlying beliefs, and then when they see somebody acting towards those beliefs, well, that increases the chance that, oh, we'll see that person acts that way because of X.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not even they're not consciously necessarily thinking that. It's kind of at this subconscious level, this unconscious level that we're seeing the bias. And we see that oftentimes even within performance reviews,
mm-hmm.
where the tasks that one gender or one race may be given compared to somebody outside their protected group is different. And so they're not even being evaluated on the same scale, nor are they mm-hmm. being evaluated for the same tasks.
Mm-hmm.
A question I had is, what since we have these unconscious biases, what can people do to either eliminate or at least offset those unconscious biases in order to hopefully have a more unbiased viewpoint?
You know, and that is the probably literally million-dollar question, right? That is, I mean, or more, you know, it's very interesting. I'm thinking about that right now. There's, I'm bidding on City of San Francisco is starting to implement online implicit bias training for all of its employees. So they've just put a contract out there. So this is something I'm thinking about. And one thing, there are a couple of things that make the task particularly difficult. So I spent 15 years teaching undergrads, right? 15 years. And I changed the way that I taught about language and gender in particular. Language and gender, over the course of 15 years, I found that I had to really, really change how I taught in order to make sure that I didn't get people immediately defensive, bristling, angry, feeling attacked, and instead receptive to what many decades of research have shown, right? Because decades of research aren't attacking particular people. You know, they're trying to show here's systematic stuff, but even just bringing it up made people feel defensive. So I think the answer is training, obviously, but one of the things that I'm thinking very hard about is how do you train people so that they don't feel attacked, especially if they're in the group, you know, like I would literally, when I would start to teach language and gender, especially I would teach in big intro classes, 300 people, 350 people, and I would start by saying, before anything, I want to tell you that what I'm going to say is not an attack on white men. I'd be like, some of my favorite people are white men, like my father and my brother, you know. So just using humor to disarm, and I'd be like, okay. And then I found that in training, what I should do was give data that was recent and local, because anytime there was data that was, and both males and females would be resistant. Like I would be like, here's a study, and they would say, but Professor Wertheim, that study's from Iowa with middle-aged white people from 20 years ago. It doesn't relate to here. So I realized I would have to get people to collect their own data and then analyze it themselves. And so mm-hmm. it's very hard to do that if you're brought in for a half-day workshop somewhere. It's very hard to do that. But what you want to do is, first of all, give training, but you can't say things like racist or sexist or misogynist or biased. Just saying those words makes people angry and defensive, and then they don't hear you. And so what I think is you present data, then you ask people to analyze it, then you ask people to find the patterns, right, and say, can mm-hmm. you find systematic patterns? And then when they've reached the conclusions themselves, then there seems to be a lot more buy-in. But what we are finding is reports, now there's been unconscious bias training and diversity training in the workplace long enough for people to see that there seems to be backlashes. at this point, it's mostly anecdotal, but it looks like diversity training is really well-intentioned in a lot of ways, but that there actually is people report that where they weren't encountering biased behavior before, especially in terms of comment, that after training, they were receiving a lot more problematic behavior. So it's a gnarly, I don't mean gnarly like a valley girl, but I mean it's difficult.
That's all right. Yeah, I'm from California, so we're used to that.
There you go. But it is a low prestige dialect, so there you go.
Yeah, I can see so many different ways that you could help, well, me and my practice as well as my clients. I mean, there's things from the diversity training that you could provide to my employer clients. Mm-hmm. There is, when I'm representing employees, oftentimes we're looking at performance evaluations or emails or other communications to see, what is the subtext to providing expert witness testimony, or even when I'm picking the jury at my next trial, there are likely things that the jurors may be saying during their voir dire or how mm-hmm. they filled out their jury questionnaires that mm-hmm. can give some insight as to where they may be coming from. And, as far as what the jury is thinking is oftentimes a mystery to even the most seasoned litigators. And so every advantage, I think, could help. We're talking mm-hmm. with Dr. Suzanne Wertheim. She's a linguistic anthropologist and the founder of Worthwhile Research and Consulting. Suzanne, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
Well, one of the good ways is to go to my website. Then you can read about things and contact me there. That's worthwhileconsulting.com.
And worthwhile is like it's a worthwhile time to call you?
Exactly. So it's a regular spelling because no one can say or spell my name. So worthwhile seemed like I wanted to, first of all, do worthwhile work, and then I also wanted people to be able to spell it. And then the other way, which is a tiny bit harder because it involves my last name, is to email me. And so that's Wertheim, Wertheim, as Mary, at worthwhileconsulting.com. So those are the best ways to reach me.
And again, the website is www.worthwhileconsulting.com, WORTHWHILE consulting.com. And your email is?
Wertheim at worthwhileconsulting.com.
And that Wertheim is WERTHEIM
as in Mary.
Thank you. Well, Suzanne, thank you very much for spending some time with us today. I'm hoping that you'll have much success in the future. You're definitely on my Rolodex, if there is such a thing as a Rolodex anymore. You're in my contact list. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and please visit worthwhileconsulting.com to learn more about Dr. Suzanne Wertheim. This is Robert Nuttleman from the Nuttleman Law Firm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.